From Mark's Dining Room Table on South First Street in Calculated, Persistent, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where the nice game devs talk gaming and game development. I'm Martha McGarry, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are scoring systems and lives and continues. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start.
What's up, y'all? How you doing?
We gotta talk faster. We're in Mark's house.
Yes,
we have to
right.
not relax, even though it's very comfortable here.
I know. I intro'd it all smooth, like, oh, we gotta be extra zippy. Not
yeah.
extra zippy, but I think last time we recorded at your place, we were slower because it's so relaxing here.
I think we did two episodes. We did one that was like that, and then we had Holly on for another one of them.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was pretty high energy.
That's yeah.
Holly's high energy.
Yeah. but yeah, Dale, my wife, recommended that we like keep the energy up because it's really easy to just sort of slip back in our chairs and relax here in this alternate clubhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the normal clubhouse is being fumigated or torn down or
something's happening.
Or they're
there.
Replacing it with, like, you know.
Yeah, there were like construction noises yesterday. This is annoying.
Actually, that's true. I was making a gag, but yeah, the bar underneath the clubhouse, which has been was the bane of our existence for the first year of our program,
yep.
And has been thankfully vacant for the second year of our program, is now being remodeled in order to attract another buyer to that space.
It came back from the grave to haunt us.
Yeah, so we'll there has been construction noises this week, so we'll see what that turns into.
Yeah,
and whether it will be good or bad for us.
Yeah,
maybe we'll just have nice new neighbors. That'd be fun.
That would be nice.
Yeah. But here we are at my place,
yeah.
Which we've recorded at before, and hopefully we'll keep that energy up for you.
Yeah. So, Martha, you went to a mini bar.
Yes, which is an awesome free unconference thing that they have every year at Best Buy headquarters. It's put on by this organization called MiniStar. And it's really cool because anybody can sign up to do a talk, and then people vote on which talks they like. Or like they're interested in going to, and then they make the rooms assignments based on how many people want to go to each talk. So you can have like a room with a bunch of people in it or a room with like five people in it, but everyone gets to do their thing. And it's a really good way to like practice talks and stuff like that. And also what's really cool and what I like every year is that the indie games like cohort of people show up and take over like half of the space in the atrium area and just set up games. Ian Fitzpatrick runs it every year.
It's like
there's
multiple stations, and each station has a library of a bunch of games. So it's not just like one per station, so you can walk up and play any game.
Yeah.
It's a pretty different, it's a cool way to demo a bunch of different things. Mm-hmm. And it has a fun name, which Steven, I've heard you say out loud, so I know you're the one to know it.
Mega Mini Multi Indie Mini Arcade.
There you go.
It's really fun to say. You also just practice it in the same way. it was cool. We had Widget Satchel there. I wasn't at Mini Bar, but I heard good things.
I saw some kids playing it.
Yeah.
So.
Your brother reported that it was the fourth most popular
game. He's ranking them, I guess.
Somehow he's able to determine. I don't
well,
know.
Well, he could determine that his game was playing constantly because the music was just like all the time.
Was it all?
Yeah, it was kind
it
of awesome.
It could be he's maybe deflating the ranking just to gag on you.
Oh, like, yeah, that makes sense. He would do that.
So it was probably the second most popular, we can say with confidence.
Yep, that sounds good. Yeah, there were a lot of games. Joggernauts was there, Hyperdot was there, Widget Satch was there. A Dev's game that he was working on, he's been on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
That was there, not Newt 1, but another game.
Something he's working on since then?
Yeah.
Cool.
And a bunch of other games like that.
Yeah.
Is there like a website for this? The Mega Mini Multi Indie Mini Arcade?
There should be a page on the mini bar.
Yep.
Right?
There was like a listing for it, and they had all the games listed in there.
We will link to that in the description.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, a bunch of people from the community gave talks. There was a mini, micro talk thing where everyone got to do 5-minute talks about indie games, and that was really cool. Ian had his kid draw all of his slides, which was amazing.
Wow.
That's great.
So it was like little kid drawings, and Adia did a talk about doing games for Amazon Alexa, which was really interesting.
Oh, she did that at
GlitchCon.
GlitchCon, but it was 50 minutes. How did she cut it down into 7 minutes?
It was 5 minutes exactly.
Oh.
Because she had no slides. Because why would you need a slide if you're talking about something that is right. all auditory. Oh, anyway, yeah, no, and sense. It was like perfect. Like she, it was amazing.
Cool.
Ava gave a talk about with a couple other people. It was like a panel about working in St. Paul and the resources that are available there. And that was really cool.
Sounds like a really sad talk.
What?
I'm just kidding.
Oh,
oh my God. There's so much cool stuff happening. Basically, yeah. the point of the talk was if you're in St. Paul or thinking of moving to St. Paul with your business, that you should talk to the city and to the Knight Foundation.
Yeah, there's lots of like small business accelerator projects.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
So yeah, they've got lots of resources for people. And basically, Ava's point was just ask them. They might do it for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah. There's like those old TV commercials with the guy in like the Riddler outfit saying like free money from the government. You know, the thing is, some of that's true. Yeah. Like you don't get what you don't ask for.
So. Yeah. And not just money, but like they might be able to connect you with the person who will like give you, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It was a really it's inspiring talk.
Yeah. My brother was in that talk too, right? He did one on enemy design, I believe.
He was stressing out about
it the whole week.
Yeah. He gave a talk about enemy design and making people care about shapes, which is true. He has made everyone care about shapes a lot.
Yeah.
Like the stars and the triangles.
Oh, he's made people hate them.
Yes.
Mostly,
yeah. That
cursed
was his
pluses.
Oh, yeah. He mentioned that you hated those.
Great. Funny. Well, it sounded like Minibar has a good time then.
Yeah, it's always a good time. Like, it's because anyone can give a talk. Like, the talk quality can vary. Like, I went to one with Nick and a bunch of other people that everyone else ended up walking out of besides me because the guy who was giving the talk was like, you could tell he was like really trying, but he was very boring. And so, but his voice was so soothing that I was just like, I want to stay and support this guy because it just seems really nice.
Yeah.
And
well, that's tricky because knowing you, you were probably at risk of falling asleep.
Oh, that's what I did. But, yeah. It was nice. But anyway, even though there's talks like that, like, it's so cool because everyone gets a chance.
Yeah.
And it's like everyone's really positive. And that's what I really
That's good.
So, yeah.
Yeah. We also wanted to talk a little bit about Star Trek, as we do.
Right.
Because Discovery just ended recently. Yeah. Season 2. So no spoilers.
Yes.
But
I will pretend. Everything is different now.
Yeah. I will pretend like I understand all of this talk. Uh-huh. I haven't seen any of Season 2. I watched like the first... I watched 6 episodes of the first season and did not like
it. Yeah, you gave it a chance.
Yeah.
And then you're like, nah, enough.
I just listened to the podcast Greatest Discovery. Don't actually watch them. But
you guys are missing out because season 2 was real, real good.
Mm.
Like the show felt more like more Star Trek.
Okay.
It felt more like the thing I loved about the very end of the first season was this idea that Star Trek does better than other shows do, which is this sort of like cynicism is popular in science fiction,
yeah,
and Star Trek's never been about that, but like sometimes it'll take little pieces of it because it's trendy, you know what I mean, and that's fine, but like what Star Trek will sometimes do is just everybody will be like, let's work together as a team and fix this dilithium chamber, and it's just like for some reason it's so simple, it's such a simple idea, but when you see it happen on Star Trek and then you like think to yourself, this doesn't happen anywhere else on television. Like people who watch like The West Wing would always talk about how it's like workplace fantasy. It's like a workplace where everyone gets along, and that makes sense. But in Star Trek, it posits a future where that is normal.
Yeah.
And like a lot of writers on Star Trek have said like, oh, it's very difficult to come with conflict when everybody is like when there's a utopia, and that's true. But the fact that that was always hanging over their heads is like this is what Star Trek is actually let them craft this great balance of a lot of those things. And Discovery really nailed it, and especially in season 2, really got it very good. They introduced Captain Pike, who is a figure from like Star Trek canon, who was in the original pilot of Star Trek instead of Kirk, and then never appeared again, at least not that actor.
Uh-huh.
And so it was like, oh, the first captain of the Enterprise. And so lots of like tie-in novels will like address that, but like there's not a lot there, right? It was just a little thing and little point of canon history.
He shows up later, but
what do you mean?
Pike does in TOS.
Oh, well, yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Oh. Not as the same actor as well.
Oh, that's right.
And so, so people, it's one of those little facts about Star Trek. Like, oh, there was a captain before Kirk. Did you know about it? And so in Discovery, they bring that character on, played by Anson Mount, and who was in, he was in the Marvel's Inhuman series. And he was in, he's in Hell on Wheels, I think. And I didn't know him very well as an actor, but I saw him in Marvel's Inhumans, and I'm like, oh, boy. And, but the thing is, man, like, totally knocked it out of the park. And at a, for a Star Trek show that is modern and has a woman of color as its lead, to bring in a white man with a square jaw, like as a new main character, everyone was like, all right, you know, we don't need that in this mod. You know, it was, it was almost like a bad look, kind of. But like the character was amazing. They did a really, really good job. And they turned it into this great ensemble. And there's this whole great arc for Michael Burnham, the main character of the show. And like a bunch of like, you know, different canon connections. So like a, it's, it was a good, it was just a better constructed show. And for like longtime Star Trek fans, there was lots of little things to like about it.
That's cool.
And then the ending, like big cliffhanger ending. So we'll see what happens.
Oh,
next
it's a cliffhanger too.
I mean, in a sense.
Okay.
you don't. Yeah, you don't really know. Yeah.
Yeah,
what's kind of, gonna happen?
Basically, it's a it's nearly a blank slate for next year. They don't really know what next season's going to be about.
Okay,
because of how much they sort of change in the finale.
Sure,
okay. Which is sort of exciting, but also kind of scary because it could be terrible. It really could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I have confidence that they'll do okay, but like, I don't have so much confidence to like to just it, you know, believe
give
it
them
fully.
A blank check or whatever.
Exactly. Right. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah,
I'm excited and that excited for that and the rest of. The other spinoffs that are happening.
Yeah, so I'm going to count these on my fingers because there's a couple of them. So the Picard series. So Patrick Stewart's returning as Picard. Mm-hmm. That started production when you listened to this a week or two ago. A bunch of really good actors have been hired as the leads on those. An actor I'm particularly interested in, Alison Pill, who was in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. She was the drummer.
Oh.
And she was also on The Newsroom, which was not a great show, but like she was good on it.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to be a lead on the show, and there's a bunch of other really cool actors. So, but Martha, you were asking before we started, like, oh, there'll be a bunch of the old TNG characters will come back. Apparently, none of them have been asked. So,
that's what makes me nervous about it. They haven't asked Gates McFadden apparently, and I'm like,
I know, that's like close to a deal breaker, actually.
Huh. I'm just hoping Janeway makes an appearance somewhere in there because
Well, she's on a hit TV show right now, so maybe that's enough to warrant a an afternoon on the set, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But there's also the there's going to be an animated show that is like a comedy. I don't think it's going to be canon, but it's a it's called Lower Decks.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be about like the junior officers.
Ooh.
So it's going to be, I think, a workplace comedy.
That's
the idea.
Fun.
I'm a little nervous about that because the premise of that is going to imply that like the command level officers are like incompetent and stupid, and it's going to be like The Office.
Oh,
That's my worry anyway. And like, that's not really Star Trek as I detailed just recently.
Yeah.
But it'll be funny either way, I guess. Mm-hmm. But a Rick and Morty writer is going to be in charge of that. So that's not necessarily evidence of its tone, but evidence of its pedigree anyway.
Sure. Yeah.
There's also going to be a Section 31 series.
Section 31 is like the evil Star Trek or something.
Yeah, it's
right?
Like the CIA.
Yeah, they're like covert ops that are sort of off the books.
Real Federation, like they don't really are down with the Federation, like peace and diplomacy.
Wow. It's an interesting conceit. It comes from DS9, and it's this. It's like the Dick Cheney of Star Trek. It's like I'll do the terrible, awful thing so you can stay comfortable in your beds, which is like kind of a terrible, you know, it has consequences.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But that's how they feel. They're like, oh, we'll do the terrible stuff, and so they feel morally right in doing that sort of thing. And then a lot of the DS9 episodes that talk about it sort of tackle that question. And so... they appeared in season 2 of Discovery.
Okay.
There was a storyline there. And so the spinoff is going to star Michelle Yeoh.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
Dang it.
Now you're going to have to watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, if you watch Discovery, the very circuitous path for that character to end up, but you know, whatever.
Okay.
But that show is going to be show run by two Discovery staff writers who I really, really like, who've written some of the best episodes of Discovery.
Okay. Cool.
But that show's not going to start for like a year or two because Michelle Yeoh is going to be in season 3 of Discovery.
Ah.
So it won't start until after that, I think.
Okay.
And then what else? There's going to be a cartoon show on Nickelodeon.
On Nick, huh?
Yeah, so this will not be on CBS All Access.
Okay.
And it'll be for kids, which is cool, right? I think that's great. Mm. I watched Star Trek as a kid, and one of the things I don't like about more modern Star Trek, including the more recent movies, is that they're not for kids.
Yeah.
And I think that Star Trek should be an adult show that kids can watch. That's because that's how I got into it.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing that Discovery does not do at all very well. Mm. Discovery is for me, people my age, and that's kind of wrong. So it's cool that they're at least trying to make up for that by having a proper kids show.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. And there's probably two or three other things in the hopper.
Well, yeah, we can count them and keep score on how many Star Treks there are.
Well played.
Very good. Good transition into my topic, which is scoring systems. This is going to be a kind of just a pretty simple idea of like, it's one of the things in gaming that has totally changed.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like from its initial conception of what it meant to the experience of a game to what it means now.
Yeah.
And that is really, that's because we're not in arcades anymore, and you know, or because we're more sophisticated production tools. But the truth is, it's because games themselves, from a design perspective, have gotten more robust and diverse.
Yeah.
And that's the reason, right? Early games use scoring in a very similar way to all the other games that were out.
Yep.
Maybe not necessarily because of it. I think just almost because of like a couple of them did it this way, and then they all did it that way. Like it was almost arbitrary in how it worked. Yeah. Essentially,
that's how a lot of design worked back then. It felt like.
Right, and then as more designers come and try more things, and then there's the space is bigger, mm-hmm. then more things can be tried. So I think a lot of people know a lot of the details in this, but I'll just run through a little bit of it. But like, you know, high scores was a big thing in arcades, right?
Right.
To tell you like how well you did, right? It's just a metric that for the most part, lots of activity in a game would give you points, and they give you different values of points. So it's very strange when you think about it this way compared to current games where like jumping on an enemy gives you this many points, collecting a bonus power gives you this many points, mm-hmm. but you don't keep track of how many enemies you jumped on.
Yeah.
Like you don't care about that. You just care about the points, and every activity is translated into a point value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even games that do use scores tend to not award it for all activity.
Yeah.
The way a lot of old games did. And I found that was the most interesting when I was thinking about this. But yeah, the idea was like how much would a quarter get you? How many millions of points could you get for your quarter? Right.
And it's really interesting because like back then there was they had high score lists and things like that.
Yeah.
There was a lot of priority on that because there's a certain amount of pride behind it. If you were high at a certain level on the high score list, and you know you're better than number five, you're number four or something.
Right,
like that.
Right. And a lot of it's asynchronous play, mm-hmm. right? So, games, that's how you'd know if you were better than your friend.
Yeah.
Because they played at the pizza parlor down the road and you played at the bowling alley or whatever. And
right,
you
could, right.
You know, so you wouldn't even have to have them on the same machine. You could still know what your score was.
I mean, also cynically, I mean, it's incentive to keep buying the game so you keep, you know, running points.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Or keep your rank. Like, if people come and bump you off the list and you have to be like, oh, well, no, I'm going to come get my score back up there.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's that.
But then a lot of that concept came home to home consoles.
Yeah.
And then was not really innovated on.
Yeah.
It was just sort of left alone to the point where even today you can get there's a score, like a 10 digit scoring track for a 2D Mario game.
Right.
Like even today.
Yeah, and it feels it. Why?
Oh, yeah.
I don't understand that.
Well, when Mario Odyssey came out, mm-hmm. and there was a thing, we're not going to keep track of lives anymore.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were like, oh, wow, that's amazing. But, like, no one's been keeping track of lives anyway,
mm-hmm.
you know, for so long.
Yeah.
And the designers have almost felt burdened by, oh, well, we need to just give you a bunch of one-ups because otherwise the system we have that we can't change for some reason, it, like, ruins the player experience.
Right.
And finally, Odyssey was just like, yeah, you just lose 10 coins.
Yep.
Like, it's fine.
Yeah. And even when you run out of coins, you just don't lose anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that is an interesting, it just shows how like resilient some of these, like these original ideas are,
mm-hmm.
to games that are long running in a franchise.
Yeah.
And how much they are to the feel of a game.
Right.
Even when you weren't keeping track of your lives in Mario 64, like you weren't expecting to need to use a continue or whatever, you still, when you lost a life, you still felt it.
Right? Yeah.
It still had a purpose.
Yeah.
It just was sort of arbitrary or artificial at that point,
yeah.
I guess. But we'll get into that when you talk in the next topic.
Yes.
But scoring is very similar. So it's just these old systems that like we've evolved on. But a lot of what we even still today the feelings we get are based on the feeling, sort of the nostalgia of it. Like, we've talked about this when we talked about color theory, like the idea that things feel a certain way because they've always felt that way.
Yeah.
Right. Because they're familiar to us. And so that's how you communicate. And so design systems work very similar. And so, but scoring in modern games is much more diverse.
Yeah.
And usually it's about the actual game mechanics. So you store how many, you know, like when you do collect-a-thons, right? How many of this you collect, or a currency that you need to use to pay for things.
Yeah. I think we've just gotten, we've gotten more robust as to like what the points actually mean in the game.
Yes.
They tend to align more with like the design concept for a game.
Right.
So like you were saying, loot systems, you know, you want to collect a bunch of things so that you give players incentive to collect things.
Mm-hmm. They become resources rather than metrics necessarily.
Yeah.
But then their secondary purposes as metrics.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of interesting.
Yeah.
But there's still a place for scores, things like shooting galleries. A lot of VR games use simple scoring mechanisms because they're, again, familiar and have a lot of utility in arcade-style games.
Yeah. And now a lot of people are playing VR games in arcades.
Yeah, that's
so.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and some our VR arcades will have leaderboards, little flat screens in the lobby that will show.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, but you know, paintball or laser tag, a similar kind of thing. So it just is about how games have they become more diverse in what they're able to award you.
Yes.
Right.
But also I think that like because we've changed how point systems work in a lot of games, like we can use them for different purposes now too.
Mm-hmm.
So like for example, in a beat 'em up sort of game like Bayonetta or Devil May Cry, they have a scoring system, but like if you don't want to, you don't have to pay attention to it. But like players who are like really into those kinds of games, they love those scoring systems because they tell you what is like best to do. Like optimal gameplay situations and things like that, but also, you know, they will try to game it so that they can get the highest score, and that's how they like will compete with one another or you know, tell people how well they did. And they have a ranking system based off of that scoring system that allows players who want to like get more in depth with the game to feel rewarded for doing that.
Right. And when you do award points for activity, then it encourages a different kind of play. So like when Mario Brothers had an arcade version, you would actually probably the motivation to get a high score because you'd be ranked, you probably would want to stomp on all the Goombas.
Mm-hmm.
But when you play it at home, you mostly just want to get to the flagpole.
Yeah.
So the motivations change. And so when you think about this in your own work, like if you have an arcade style game, you want to do high scores, that's great and that'll make sense and no one will bat an eye.
Mm-hmm.
But think about how that affects the motivations of your players and think about if you do something interesting with that. Think about if you're doing it just because that's how it's supposed to work or because it's what you want to do, right? And then if you want to do something different, how do you introduce that to a player in a way that like they will go along with, right? Like will confounding their expectations, will that be something you're like, oh, that's interesting, or like, oh, that's uncomfortable, right? And so that's going to be kind of even systems as old as that people still hold on to if your design systems imply that the traditional way.
Yeah, and it's interesting how like because like games kind of they transferred into home consoles and stuff and people started playing them at home. A lot of like the way that players compared themselves to other players changed from scores to time. Because people compete in speed runs and no one really competes in scoring systems unless it's an old arcade game like Donkey Kong or something like
that.
I don't know the story behind all of that, but like I think it makes a lot of sense because like when you purchase this expensive console and this game, you just want to play the game and then beat the game, and you had a bunch of them. So you would just like beat the game, and it didn't matter what score you got because like that's not what you would brag to your friends about. You just I beat this and you didn't. In an arcade game, you could brag about like how far you got, but people didn't have infinite amount of times to play the game. So that's what they could brag about. And they could use the score as a comparison.
Right. And those games didn't have ends.
Yes, they didn't have ends as well. Especially, older arcade games definitely didn't have ends. So that was what you needed to do to compare yourself.
When you watch like scores. A Donkey Kong high score run or a Pac-Man high score run, it's interesting because sometimes you'll hear with commentary or in a documentary or something. Mm-hmm. And someone will say, like, see how they're not finishing the level yet so they can get more points?
Yeah.
even though that's really always been the strategy, that still feels a little clever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and, it totally does.
So when you think about if you're designing, well, you know, in Widget Satchel, it's like the goal is to get to the end, like any platformer. but and we don't have a scoring system, but we have things that you can be scored on. Mm-hmm. And they require you to hold back a little and not make it to the end.
Yeah.
And so that still is a part of how we design games.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the scoring systems. Yeah, they do encourage you to like get more out of the game.
Yeah.
As a result, which is interesting.
I think when we added scores to Clawbreaker, that made people get way into it too. Also, let them keep track of how many times they've played it.
Right. Yeah, because we used to not keep track of wins or anything at all. Yeah. But now, yeah, once you get wins, and really, like in Clawbreaker, wins are practically points.
Yeah.
As quickly as those games go.
Wait, so, is there just like a? I didn't know there was a scoring system.
Oh, at the end, there's just a. It's not a scoring system, really. It's like, did you win?
Oh, okay.
And then it keeps track of which crab won.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Just okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I guess just like how quickly all of those things go, it's a little. It feels like a scoring system in a way.
Yeah, right. Because points rack up quickly.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. So metric, yeah. People are like, let's play till 60. Like, whoever gets 60 wins first or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the sort of, it's almost like the rock, paper, scissors or like, you know, just something you do over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Best of this, best of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
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 But it does feel like a lot of times like point systems are vestigial mm-hmm. aspects of games. Like, fighting games still have point systems, like, because they have an arcade mode.
Yeah.
Because you know, there's sometimes people will buy fighting games and then just play it by themselves, and I don't understand why they do that.
Right.
Because then you don't have to deal with other people.
But it's a fighting game, and you're supposed to deal with.
But then you don't have to go against all the good people who will beat you every time.
But that's anyway.
It's not fun to lose.
Okay.
I mean, it's fine to be like the champ of the local arcade.
Yeah.
But like, when the only way to play with other people is to play with every other person.
Yeah.
Then, you know.
I suppose.
I mean, matchmaking notwithstanding.
Yeah.
It's less appealing.
Okay. Sure.
But we might not be true fans like you.
Steven's like, well, I don't know you people.
Why am I here? No. But they still have arcade modes, and they have scoring systems that to me seem rudimentary, or like they're confusing.
Yeah.
Because like a lot of times they will encourage you to do things that you would not do in a match.
Oh,
like,
weird.
Yeah, like for example, in Soul Calibur games, there are moves called unblockable attacks that are, you know, unblockable, but they're extremely slow. They take like a second to come out or something, and anybody, if you're fighting against anybody else, they'll easily dodge it in most cases. But you get a lot of points for hitting that. In the arcade mode version, so it like encourages you to spam those moves a lot, which you would not do in a regular game.
Isn't that just a risk reward thing? Because
it is a risk reward.
You spam thing. It a lot, and you've wasted some time, and you've only gotten the score benefit maybe once or twice of all the spamming you've done.
Yeah, right? I mean, it is a risk reward thing because it's hard to hit and stuff like that. But I think it encourages players to like use those moves more frequently than they ever should in a lot of cases.
It's like trying.
Oh, this is just you just have an ideological opposition,
right?
Yeah. Now I got it.
Yeah,
it's training them the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Uh huh.
Yeah. So I think like in cases like, and I think that like, I mean, like Mario has a bunch of these. They have scoring. It has scoring systems. The 2D Mario games still have scoring systems, but like I don't think anybody pays attention to those.
No, and the numbers are so inflated and weird. Like you don't have a sense of like what is a high score,
mm-hmm.
what is a good, because you always just get many thousands immediately.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I mean, by design, like what game doesn't give you 100 points for something,
right?
You know, that it is sort of, it's a little strange.
Yeah.
And part of that is like a 100 visually is takes up more space and feels more like a marker than one does. Like it just takes up more pixels,
mm-hmm.
like, and is more, it could be more readable as a number in a sense. So I wonder how much of that is just about like visual design.
Yeah.
But also there's the sort of like the sort of slot machine idea of it, that it's just it just racks up fast.
Yeah.
And the number is so high.
Yeah.
That like that becomes the, like lives is in single digits. Power ups is in double digits, mm-hmm. score is in quadruple digits. Like it's just where we think they belong.
Yeah.
But I would like to see a game where like the high score is like 76. why not? You know,
yeah.
Like, it depending on how many actions generate points. But like, I'd be curious to see how players would react to something like that.
Well, I think a game like that would be Flappy Bird.
Yeah.
You get like 6 points and that's high score.
Right. Well, yeah, those are games where like, or like in Clawbreaker, like there's one metric and one thing that awards you points.
Yeah.
And I think people do treat that a little differently. Like, you know, like Flappy Bird, how many of those?
Yeah.
But if you got, you know, more points for getting closer to between the pipes than Graves. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then that might be a different kind of way to play the game.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like in the mobile game space, scoring systems are a lot more important than they are in console games.
Well, that's what I was thinking too when you were talking about like score inflation. Like, if you want a game that's just a scoring mechanism, play like all those cookie clicker type games.
Oh,
click
yeah,
games
yeah.
are basically just the score.
Mm-hmm.
And sans anything else.
Right.
Which is kind of cool. Like, it's really fun. I can't remember which one Dylan was playing, but he was playing some idle game while he was playing other games. Like, he likes having two going at once.
It's an effective use of your time.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you're playing Elite Dangerous, because, like...
Because that is just by itself not an effective use of your time.
Yeah. It just takes a long time to get through between planets, Mark.
Yeah.
Not everyone has, you know, wormholes and hyperdrives and stuff. Anyway, so yeah, he was playing this one. I can't remember what it was, but like the score got into like the one higher than trillion. Like
yeah.
They started making up numbers.
Oh, wow.
After that.
That's cool.
Which was pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that I wonder why it feels like it's more important in mobile games. Maybe it's because they're a lot of times, I guess now that I think about it, they're built similarly to how arcade games were built.
Yeah, charitably, that's how you describe it. Incharitably, it's like they're closer to casino games.
Sure.
Which are about engaging the lizard brain, mm-hmm. and high numbers do that.
Yeah.
But I think that's definitely true. They are close to the arcade mechanics.
Yeah.
So it makes more sense to those designs.
Yeah, it totally does.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I think about it, I don't think they have like very complicated scoring systems. Arcade puzzle games like Treasure Stack or Tetris and things like that, mm-hmm. they have more complicated systems, and that's oftentimes how you will compete between one another. Though I guess also you like were trying to eliminate your opponent. So if it's like a time-based thing, then maybe you would like compare scores to do it.
Sure.
But yeah, they have more complicated scoring systems that are, you know, interesting. Like in Treasure Stack, when you make a match, it increases your combo meter up to a limit up to 5. And every time you make a match with a chest, you will unlock that chest, and then you will get points based off of your combo meter.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to just keep your combo meter up. So you want to constantly make matches as many as you can.
Yeah.
And that will increase your score a lot. So when you're playing it by yourself, that's the way you get a high score, is you just keep making matches. And everything in the game like encourages you to do that.
Right. So one of the things people have said frequently about Treasure Stack is that unlike other types of block dropping games, your goal isn't to build up a field and then clear it all at once. It's to continually clear elements, and that throws people off at first.
Mm-hmm.
But sounds like this scoring system somewhat explains that motivation.
Yeah,
because it rewards you with points when you play that way.
Yes. And like all of those points are important because not only do you get higher score, but you also remove potential garbage blocks that can get sent onto your field.
Right.
And you're playing both single player and multiplayer.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen players pay attention to their score?
I only see that really in the case of single player games, because the way you win in a multiplayer game is you just survive longer than your opponent.
Right.
People have been paying. There are some really high numbers in our Discord channel.
Yeah.
Higher than my boss, who's played the game the most out of any of us. They've gotten higher scores than him. So, thanks for playing the game a bunch. I think that depending on like what kind of game you're making, the scoring system can have an impact. But I think in a lot of cases, the scoring systems aren't necessarily important. It can help encourage gameplay, but like I don't know if I guess it's like an extra goal, a different goal you can have in the game. It's like a separate thing you can do.
Right. And the question for the designer is, if you put the score up on the top of the screen where it's historically been for in older games, if you do that for yours, like let's say your game is a retro inspired thing, so that's the reason you put your score there,
right?
Is it a first class mechanism for players to engage with, or is it a way to extend the life of the game for players who have already played through it? In which case, is up there in the on the part of the screen, like, is that the best place for?
Yeah,
it, right.
Yeah.
How you in You know, it's thoughtful design, like we've preached on this show before. Like, why are you putting it there versus why are you hiding it, perhaps? So in Widget Satchel, we do have our mischief score.
Yeah.
right? And those are definitely inflated numbers because they're meant to be ridiculous.
Right.
So in Widget Satchel, you don't know this score, but as you play, you can knock around bits of junk and hit bots more than you have to and do silly things. Mm-hmm. And everything you do that is not part of the main goal of the game gives you points.
Yeah.
So it's sort of an inverse idea.
Yeah.
But that score and what each activity is worth is hidden from the player. Mm-hmm. By design, so that it becomes a thing they can suss out or figure out, but also a way to tell them that it's not that important.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
I'm really curious how that's going to play in the wild for people who, say, want to get a high mischief score.
Yeah.
Because it may come out in ways that we didn't intend. I'm kind of excited to see that, frankly. Mm-hmm. And we did design it in a way where, like, however it's received, it should work.
Yeah.
Our lack of confidence is part of the design, in a sense. But the only way you can actually see your mischief score is from the main menu of the game. You can't pause and check.
Yeah.
And that was a deliberate choice we made.
Right.
Because, one, we didn't want people worrying about it, right? And like, micromanaging it. Mm-hmm. But we also wanted it to be something that players who weren't good at the game, who spent more time noodling around, mm-hmm. and rather than trying to, like, get all the things, or maybe they made multiple attempts to get that one widget and failed.
Yeah.
They end up racking up mischief points because in the time they spend, they're knocking things around more often.
Right, yeah.
It's meant to be a little sibling-friendly mechanic,
yeah.
in a sense. Again, yeah. how it's going to work in the wild, I'm not totally mm-hmm. certain, but because even in playtests, it's hard for us to engage fully with that mechanic.
Yeah, it's a way to be good at widgets actually in a different way.
Yeah. It's a way to be rewarded for being bad at Widget Satchel. Yeah. And you can look at it however you like. That's mm-hmm. that's the key of it. And so that's how we approached that. Basically, like, scores are silly. Let's make our scores silly.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
You know. Oh. Does Fingen's have scoring?
It does not. So, I mean, you get scrap based on
right.
killing things.
That's resources.
Right. But yeah, it's resources. You use that to buy things.
You get scores based on how many things you've hit, right?
Oh well, yeah. We do record
temporary scores.
We record stats.
Yeah, we record your damage, how much damage you dealt, how much damage you took, how much damage you healed, and things like that.
I guess those aren't really points, though.
Yeah. Well, I mean, players, myself included, use those to, like, say you're better than another player or something at a thing. Yeah. So,
well, you know, it's really interesting because the problem I've had at mm-hmm. that result screen for Fingen's is that. If you play as, the tank-like character, mm-hmm. you get a lot of tanking points, right?
Yeah.
And if you don't, if you play as a weaker character that can move faster, you don't get any of those points. Mm-hmm. So there's not really a real value to comparing me to that player,
because
I know they're going to have higher than me, so I don't place any value on that. Likewise, with, like, high damage, that seems to the thing that could be the most thing that could level out, right? Yeah. Where all things being equal, whoever lands the most hits or does the most damage. But again, some players are better suited for that.
Right.
Some killers are support players.
Yeah.
And you have these different metrics that you tell the players. But I would almost suggest finding a way to turn them all into points. Mm. And this becomes something you have to decide what's worth what.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a balancing act. But then there would be something that players could compare to each other.
That's a good point.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. That's because, like, there are only, like, two or three characters in the game who can heal, and mm-hmm. we still have a healing stat, like, prominent in in that stat screen, which a lot of players have been like, why is this even here? I can't heal.
Yeah, like, maybe just an overall score, and then you can hit a button to break it down or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a really hard task, because how do you make it... How do you reward certain behavior or other behavior?
Yeah.
But a lot of games will have different ways to keep... So instead of points, they'll give you different metrics to track. And then two players can compare their score on these different metrics. But with a class-based game like Fingen's, it's harder to compare those things.
Yeah. You could give players a ranking, I guess, based on, like, how well they did for their team.
Yeah.
On their
stats,
maybe.
Right. Give players, an A, B, C, D... use S also, because for some reason you could use that system mm-hmm. And then every character could have a different metric by which you rank them, so that you don't have to worry about comparing necessarily. It's just how good of a Sparky they were.
Sparky.
Of course, that's a lot of work.
Oh yeah we don't advocate a lot of work here on the show.
It's true. Creep. So if scoring systems are used to extend the life of the game, something something lives and continues.
Cool. All right. So,
yeah.
We didn't give you a lot to go on there.
Extend the life of the game.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And they'll allow you to continue playing it.
There we go.
There we go. There we go.
Boom. Got it. All right.
Got it in one.
Yes. My topic is lives and continues, which is, I feel like another thing that has been like another game design thing that like was in arcades a lot of times, but it has transferred into modern games not quite gracefully.
Yeah.
We put these two in the same show because they have synergy. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And so we can catch ourselves saying the same thing again.
Yep.
So just, you know, keep a tally at home.
Right. So yeah, Lives and Continues really were meant in arcade games to like, you know, for people to keep buying arcade tokens. So they could keep playing the game and keep getting higher scores or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, arcades don't really exist anymore. Well, I shouldn't say that. They don't really exist that much in the States. And, like, they're more like Dave and Buster's now, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know how that works. But they were more popular in, like, Japan.
Yeah.
But Lives and Continues still exist in modern games. Like, Mario games, mm-hmm. 2D Mario games still have Lives and Continues. Kirby games have Lives and Continues and stuff too. Mm-hmm. And I guess they always have because I don't think Kirby exists in arcade games. And they're oftentimes mainly used in like platformers or shoot 'em ups or something like
that. Now I'm imagining a Kirby arcade cabinet that is like one of the ones you sit in and it's just a big plexiglass pink sphere.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
You climb into.
Oh my God.
Would buy. I'll use all my salary for that. That's fine. Yeah.
You have to go to Dave and Buster's to play it though.
No.
They got chicken wings.
That's true. Oftentimes these are used in platformers or shoot 'em ups, but they've been seen in other games as well. Mm-hmm. Doom doesn't have a live system, right? The old Doom, I guess.
You know, I don't know.
I don't know
what happens when you die. I played that game a lot when I was younger. I must have never died. That must be it.
Okay. but like there are a few differences between like what lives are and what continues are. It's mm-hmm. a little bit confusing because like they haven't been used consistently.
Some games don't make a huge distinction even when they have both.
Yeah.
And some it's a real big deal.
Right. But in most cases, lives are like the things you this is like your individual chance for the player to get through this particular level. And if you lose a life, like if you fall in a pit or you lose all your health or something like that, you have to start back at the checkpoint. Whatever, or in that level you did, or that level specifically, if you didn't find a checkpoint, or there are no checkpoints.
Yeah.
In older games, a lot of times lives, there were extra lives, and like the scoring systems actually would give you extra lives. So that was a purpose of the extra life or the scoring systems back then. But like they were hard to come by, and they were really easy to lose because, you know, they wanted your money. But newer games, they tend to give players a ton of lives. Like when I played Kirby Game on the Switch, I got like over 500 lives by the end of the level, and I started with like 3. Yeah. So yeah, they just threw them at you. And especially in the beginning they will give you a lot of lives, whereas continues are specifically like chances you have to complete the game. So in like Super Mario Brothers, the original Super Mario Brothers, you would have 3 lives to complete the level. When you lost the life, you would, you know, start back at that beginning of that level. But if you are on level 5-1 or something and you lost all of your lives and you ran out of continues, then you would have to start back at the beginning from level 1-1, which really sucked.
It's interesting because like, so a continue, I'm thinking very much of like the beat 'em ups where when you die, it says continue 9-8-7. And then when you put the quarter in, it picks up exactly where you left.
Yes. That's how Vengeance works too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then, you know, my first gaming experience was at home with the NES, and you would get like the standard was like 3 continues.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like the system was so weird. People are familiar with that idea. You get this many lives, this many continues, but continues are really a mechanic of the arcade.
Yeah.
That you continues can be infinite if you continue to pay out.
Right.
And that having like 3 continues is weird.
Yeah.
And then continues became less about picking up exactly where you left off, and more about picking up from a super checkpoint.
Right.
And so it's very strange.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, especially like I think especially in a lot of modern platformers, because they'll have lives, and like if you fall down a pit you'll lose a life, but if you run out of lives in like say Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze, you just start back at the beginning of the level because like
there's like saves now and like auto saves and things like that. And mm-hmm. they keep track of all of those things. And so like it never really feels like you're losing a ton of progress when you lose all of your lives or you run out of continues or whatever else. It just feels like you have to start that level over again.
Yeah.
Which is what you're going to do when you lost anyways.
Right.
So it's really weird.
Yeah.
So I feel like lives and continues are outdated systems in a lot of cases. Like a lot of times games will give you a ton of lives that you just never use. Like I said, Kirby, I ended up having 500 lives at the end of the thing, and I did not need 500 lives. And I also feel like a lot of hardcore platformers nowadays like to just get rid of all those live systems completely so that you can just keep trying it over and over again. Mm-hmm. Hyperdot doesn't have lives, for example. I guess it's not a platformer, but like once you lose, you just start the level over again immediately afterwards. Meat Boy is the same way.
Yeah, like roguelikes and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Games that have quick restarts tend to not keep track of lives because they expect you to die a lot.
Yeah, right, which they have in common with old school platformers or old school arcade games. But the motivations for playing the games have changed.
But like you could not make every life in Super Meat Boy worth a quarter in the arcades.
Yeah.
You'd have to give them in packs of 30 or something.
Yeah.
And even that would not be a good arcade experience necessarily because it would feel bad as you got closer to the end of your quarter.
Right.
Instead of the tension of maybe losing your quarter.
Yeah.
Right. So like the mechanic wouldn't necessarily work in a system that actually cared of running out of them.
Yeah.
Lives, you know?
Yeah. And I also think like in modern games, we have better systems for like losing that makes you feel like you are running out of resources or, you know, like makes your losses feel important.
Yeah.
Like Dark Souls games, you know, if you die, you lose all of your stuff.
Right.
And so you want to keep all your stuff so you don't lose. Or you try not to anyway.
You just make the choice to not lose.
Right.
So you can keep all your stuff.
Yeah.
That's how video games work.
Oh, man.
Exactly.
There's some combat stuff that I've had to do in my time in Portia to do some of the missions. And man, combat kind of sucks in that game because if you don't lose very often because the enemies are all real easy to beat.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do, then you have to go back to the beginning of the day.
Oh.
Your last save point.
Ah, yeah.
I was like, because in Stardew Valley, if you lose, then you wake up, like, you lose that day that you were on, like, because you wake up at night and are like, oh, you know, we found you last night, you know.
You don't lose progress.
You don't lose progress. You don't lose potential. What you've already done. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It's a really interesting way to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it feels kind of like an oversight. Like, oh, crap, what do you do when you die? I guess we'll just reload it.
Yeah.
But that does not feel as good as having lives, I don't think. Like, so I guess it depends on the context.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because like it can be used as a method to like tune the difficulty in a lot of ways. Like in Fingence, for example, we have continues, even though I just said the continues are outdated, because we wanted to make it so that the easier difficulties are easier for players who, you know, they like just want to play the game or you know, just starting out the game and they're trying to figure out how to play.
Yeah.
And so we give them more continues so like they can make mistakes and they don't get punished as hard as a player who's played on playing on the harder difficulties, because you get less continues on harder difficulties.
But also your continues are basically like group lives.
Yeah.
Right. Because a player can it takes longer to respawn after every death.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as other players are still going, you have infinite lives.
Yes.
It's only when all the players are wiped out that the option to continue appears.
Right.
So it's called a continue because it's familiar to players, but it doesn't work the same way.
That's true.
And giving the group a finite amount of continues is basically saying the group has three or four lives or whatever.
Yep.
So like I feel like that is a perfectly suitable way to implement a live system. Calling it a continue, I think, leverages into what people are familiar, used to seeing, especially because you do actually continue the game.
Right. Yeah, you immediately start out where you just got your team defeated. Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like you've almost sort of like taken the expectation and transferred it onto a more modern mechanic. Like I don't see anything anachronistic or old fashioned about how you've done it.
Oh yeah, you know? No, we're real modern here in this game industry. I think we did a good job implementing it. But I don't know. I feel like in a lot of cases, like lives just they don't make any sense to have in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like I really like the change that they made in Super Mario Odyssey to just use coins, because I mean, it's still like a minor inconvenience because you lost 10 coins. Yeah. But like even then, it's barely anything because you earn so many coins in that game.
Right. And you and then it the player who is wanting to get every coin, mm-hmm. not that you actually can in that game because they are kind of an infinite resource.
Yeah.
But the player who wants to especially earn up to buy that cosmetic thing in the shop.
Right.
Like that player does care about those 10 coins. Mm-hmm. But it's so little that if you don't really care about it, then you don't care at all about it.
Right.
And so it actually works for both types of players.
Yeah.
Like if you lost 100 coins, then you would have players not want to collect any new coins mm-hmm. because they're so easy to lose. Mm-hmm. But because it's just that amount, then the player who's not keeping a huge track of it doesn't notice, but the player who is keeping a tracking of it will notice.
Yeah, they'll notice, but even then they still won't feel, it won't be the worst thing in the world. It'll right. still suck a little
but
bit.
But it still works as a motivator to yeah. not fall down the
oh,
cliff.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that like the way lives work in a lot of cases, they will demotivate you from like experimenting or trying new things.
Yeah.
Which actually, now that I think about it, in a lot of platformers makes sense because you want them to do the thing that you programmed the game to do. But like in Super Mario Odyssey or other games like that, it will prevent you from trying to experiment. And so I think maybe that was to the detriment of Super Mario 64 because mm-hmm. it had lives. But like you didn't want to lose your lives because I guess actually if you lost all your lives, you would just start back at the castle. So you didn't lose a lot of progress, but like you seeing that number go down just makes you feel bad.
Yeah.
And so it makes you not want to like try like jumping over this gap because you might fail and you might lose your lives and that would suck.
Mm-hmm.
So like in those instances, I think maybe it is a detriment to that game. But yeah, I think that like in a lot of cases, it can be useful. If you're going for like an arcade feel, it can make sense to do lives. Like Vengeance yeah. is kind of going for an arcade feel, but mm-hmm. we don't use lives in the exact same way.
Yeah.
And if you're using lives as a way to earn money, I guess, and get people to buy lives, it's good for microtransactions and those kinds of purposes.
Mm-hmm.
It can be used to mitigate difficulty in some ways, like I was talking about with Vengeance. So
yeah,
there are options for it. I don't think it's like so outdated that you should just never use them. But
right.
Like,
right.
But like you should just think it through before you just put it in just because other games have done it.
Yeah, there's still a place for giving a character 3 or 4 lives, mm-hmm. and then when they lose them, make them start the whole game over.
Yeah.
Depends on the type of game.
Right.
Right? Depends on what does lost progress mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you have a game where there's lots of inventory building and, like, managing and leveling up, and then you give them they run out of continues and have to start the game over, yeah. like, that is incredibly punishing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're a more traditional platformer where you start out with all the skills you're ever going to have.
Yeah.
Like, losing the whole game isn't really a big deal.
Right.
Necessarily.
Yeah, because you could just do it again.
Yeah. In Witch's Satchel, there are no lives, and mm-hmm. you can't die.
Yeah.
And so that was a choice we made somewhat arbitrarily at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then we leaned into.
Mm-hmm.
And what the problem that we've had in Witch's Satchel is that we have failure points where you fall down a pit, and then it takes you back, so you have to work your way back. That could be a little tedious in places. We tried to mitigate that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, losing lives is a good way for players to in their mind be like, oh, I'll try that again.
Yeah.
And because Witch's Satchel doesn't have that like moment where it's like, try it again.
Yeah.
We've had to design levels to give you that. And that's been an unexpected challenge.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was kind of difficult to do that because, yeah, it's just so different from other games. Most games you have, they're, you know, a pit. And even if you don't have a lives, you just start back at the beginning of the thing. There's a restart
point. Yeah.
Where Widget Satchel, you have to literally crawl your way back over to the starting point, which, I mean, is even worse because it feels like you're wasting your time attempting it and wasting your time getting back.
Right. So one of the things I've done when I'm designing sections of that game is to reward failure. So put fun things down in that pit,
mm-hmm.
either extra widgets or just things to knock around so that, I mean, even if you have to do it over and over and over again, you don't feel bad having done it at all.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think that's some limited success. It's being honest about like the problems we've introduced in the game.
Yeah.
Benefits is that like, especially for younger players, like, dying has a meaning, like mm-hmm. it means failure in a different way than just missing the jump feels. And so I think that that's a thing we don't have in the game, and that's been really interesting. Mm-hmm. But also, it keeps the players engaged for a little longer because it doesn't actually tell them, doesn't give them any moment to stop and think, like, maybe I'm done with this game.
Yeah, that's true.
So we've had players play for longer mm-hmm. and not realize it's because the game never gave you any opportunity to leave.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I don't know if we did that on purpose, but like...
It works out,
yeah. I will say, Martha, we had playtests last night, and the most difficulty anybody ever had was in the sections you designed.
Yeah.
They're like, who is the sadistic puzzle master who made me make these perfectly timed jumps? And I didn't want to tell them it was someone who doesn't like platformers that much.
Well, you know, gotta let people know how I feel, I guess.
Oh, they'll know afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I was charged with making uh-huh. something with lifts and belts, yeah, and that's yeah. what I did. Yep. So
they are very well designed.
Yeah, that's the yeah. thing, is that people will say, like, man, things have been sort of a cakewalk up to now, but now they're really asking something from me.
Yeah. I mean, there's ways to get around it.
Yeah.
Yeah, players figure it out. Jeez.
Yeah, but I've asked, especially because that's where the game is the most difficult. I've asked players, like, you know, is it like, how frustrating is it? Is it different from if it were just you were to die, like a Super Meat Boy kind of thing? And pretty much, I mean, what a player is feeling, what they say they're feeling is different.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I think we get away with it. I think people don't seem to be lashing out at that. They may not realize, if they were to understand, like, oh, if you did, if it just reset you back up at that spot if you fell, mm. or if it went back even a little further, but you didn't have to backtrack or whatever, if you gave them a poll, we might get some players who would prefer it the other way.
Yeah.
But nobody's asking for it, so... Still a little nervous about what a reaction will be, but I think yeah. we're doing okay.
Well, you can take them out if you want. If it's too hard for people.
No. They're staples. They need to stay.
Okay.
Really, what it represents is a failure of the rest of us to design challenging platforming systems.
That's a good point.
So they're staying.
Yep.
That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app, and be sure to give it a good review if you like it or are nice like us. We really do need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. And if you see us around at events or hear us, feel free to say something, because at Minibar, one of our listeners, Andy, turned around and was like, I recognize your voice. You're on that podcast. And it was great. So thanks, Andy.
That's 2 for 2 for Minibar appearances for you, right? Yeah. That happened to you last year.
Yeah. So it's pretty fun when that happens. So yeah, feel free to reach out to us. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club, and email us at contact@nicegames.club. Lastly, you can find out more about the show and your nice hosts, as well as get all the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly 1 in 4 consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.